Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Akshay Shah, Group Executive Director of SIL Africa, one of Africa's leading players in sustainable plastics packaging. Over the past three decades, Akshay helped expand operations across East Africa while partnering with major global FMCG brands to build reusable, recyclable, and circular packaging systems. His work extends well beyond manufacturing, though. He has also co-founded and invested in ventures like Ponia Health and Way Out, focused on digital healthcare access and clean drinking water. He has also taken on major leadership roles in organizations such as YPO, EO, and Endeavor. Through all of it, he has lived the full arc of the multi-generational experience, the expectations, the pressures, the pivots, the failures, the reinvention, and the transition from operator to strategist to mentor to someone building a healthier, more intentional life. Akshay, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's get right into it. You often describe, when we talk about your early years, the factory, one of the first factories, the one in Tanzania, where it all began, as something of a childhood playground. How did growing up on the factory floor shape the leader you would eventually become?
I think because the factory was, it was essentially a maker space. There was machines producing things, injection molding, blow molding machines. I remember a rotary injection molding machine that was making these flip-flops, something that we call Crocs today. And then there was a carpenter's workshop. There was the other workshop where they had the metal working machines like lathe machines and drilling machines. And all of that really sparked my imagination of making stuff. And so I would say it helped me to become more of a creator, a maker. And that I've applied that in everything I do in terms of whether it's my business or even outside.
So was it fun for you to be at, to go with your dad to the factory? Was that fun as a little kid?
Yeah, definitely. I think from a child, as a young child, I always had this sort of creative angle or a creative bent, always liked to be making something, painting something. So that definitely being in the factory fueled that. But also the ride back home in the afternoon after work was just me and my dad, right? Mm-hmm. And just having that moment, maybe sometimes there'll be no conversation, sometimes there'll be a little bit that we talk about. That those were, I may not necessarily remember what we talked about, but I do remember those being like special moments for me.
Cool. So your family has, going back to your family, has very entrepreneurial roots, both in manufacturing and then also in trading. So very different business models. But if you could talk for a minute, how did those two maybe influence you and how you approached growing up and eventually taking leadership roles in the family enterprise?
I think it's a typical immigrant kind of a story here, right? Like my dad's side of the family, first generation immigrants into East Africa. My mom's side, second generation immigrants. So her father would have been probably 12 years old when he moved. Actually, it was her grandfather who moved to East Africa. Okay. And I think the trading business created a certain DNA, which is probably, I would say, the words to describe it is being agile, being a bit dynamic, having a really good sense of money and value for money. I would say all of those things were part of the DNA, not that it was being experienced, because by the time the family had moved from trading to manufacturing, I was quite young, or I was born around that time, actually. So the agility in being able to pivot on a dime, maybe that comes from that sort of trading DNA. But at the same time, growing up in a manufacturing family really helped to create a sort of thinking in terms of decades, right? Like in any case, it's a multi-generation family. We think in terms of generations anyway. But as far as manufacturing is concerned, when we start thinking in terms of decades, it really affects how we build customer relationships, how much we invest in customer acquisition. I'm not in a rush. I'm trying to create a customer for life. It also affects how we invest in technology. We're not trying to buy something cheap and make a quick buck. It's about long-term sustainability and picking the right machinery and hiring the right people gives us a sort of long-term sustained competitive advantage. And I think that was the benefit of the exposure to manufacturing, that think long-term, and then from trading was to be agile in the moment.
Wow, that's a great answer and a lot to unpack there, but also seeing the two sides of the two businesses that you were exposed to. Obviously, we were all probably more than we could fully appreciate are influenced by that previous generation and how it shapes our thinking about the world and about what's possible. I'm thinking of a previous guest who, you know, and I asked about why did you start this business? He's like, my family, that's what you did. Everybody had a business. He's like, that's, it's just like, it was like, why are you asking me? That's just what we do. So it's like, okay. People do other things, but okay, in your family, that's what you do.
Yeah,
but going
yeah.
back to those early years, you offered up a cute story. You said, hey, my office when I was a kid was the telex room. And probably some listening don't even know what a telex is. I remember what a telex is. We had a telex number here. But what did like being included, even as a young child, teach you about that whole idea of belonging and responsibility as it related to the greater family business?
Yeah, so that at that time, this was before anyone had desktop computers and businesses, right?
Of course.
And before, obviously, before smartphones, before fax machines. So the telex machine was like after the injection molding presses, right? The telex machine might have been the second most expensive piece of equipment in the business. And so one was like, all right, I'm in this room with this expensive machine. And I think it's also like the other thing about this is technology, right? It's there's messages coming from different parts of the world, and you could see them coming out in this strip with all these dots in it. And to me, it was like, wow, this is global communication happening right here in front of me, real time.
Yeah.
So that was having an appreciation of technology. And I didn't even think about it until you asked me this question, like, how did it affect me? The other thing around responsibility was that the deal I had with my dad was that as long as I finish my homework for the day, I can leave that telex office. So there was a lot of, I guess, discipline that kind of was inculcated through that simple little deal. Because as much fun as it was looking at this telex machine, after a while, it's nothing exciting happening. And so I wanted to be very clear about, I've got my homework ready, I'm going to get it done, and then I'm going to be able to go out and play in the factory. And so that also created this idea that finish what I start, get things done on time. And I would say building that conscientious personality, there's a lot that came out of that simple little side office with a simple rule.
Absolutely. And it's bringing back a lot of my own memories as a child coming into work with my dad, often on a Saturday or a Sunday. And yeah, there was a telex. So there were probably three critical pieces of equipment here, which was probably the telex, the copier machine, and the phones. So I managed to break two of them in one afternoon. Being the telex,
you know,
and the copier.
Yeah, just on that point, there's another experience I remember with my dad. This is all about going with my dad to the factory. And this used to happen whenever we'd have to go pick up somebody from the airport. Because again, back in those days, there was no such thing like an Uber. Somebody just takes an Uber and comes home. It was normal if we're receiving a guest, family or friend or business, that we go to the airport. And sometimes those airport pickups would be late at night.
Sure.
So my dad would take me along, and on the way to the airport, he would pass by the factory and just to drop in and see what's happening during the night shift. And for those who are in manufacturing, the night shift is not the same as a day shift.
No.
Like people get up to all kinds of stuff in the night shift. And I remember once he walked up upon this person who was sleeping, right? There was these plastic raw material bags, and he had stacked them up into a nice bed, and he was just sleeping. My dad didn't say anything. He didn't try to wake up the guy or anything. He just asked someone to bring a bucket of water and just woke him up with that. Just a very hands-on approach of how he used to keep tabs on what's happening.
That's funny. That's funny. And very true. Very true. Yes. Night shift. Interesting things can happen at night shift.
Yeah.
So going back to a little bit further down your journey, when you went to college, you studied computer science and MIS at a time when, I guess, technology was not really yet central in East African industry. Mm-hmm. When, first of all, tell me about why did you pick that path? What was it? Help me understand that.
Yeah, so I don't remember exactly when. Maybe when I was, I don't know, 10, 11 years old, I got an Atari and started playing computer games. And then my cousin brother, his name is Jayesh, he got a Commodore 64. And he would let me come to his house and use that computer. The Commodore 64 was actually more powerful than the Atari because I could do programming on it.
Yeah.
And so I got into sort of using the computer as a tool rather than as a game. And then that led to, I think when I was 12 years old, the school introduced a computer lab. So this is the first time we're seeing computers in the school. There were four IBMs, desktops, and we got into learning how to code.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, my dad makes this momentous decision of buying an Apple IIe. Now, just to put it into perspective, the cost of that computer, including the cost of the import duties, because Tanzania, being a socialist country at the time, was afraid of technology, right? If one computer comes into the country, everybody will be unemployed. I think that was, I'm exaggerating, but that was the mindset.
Okay.
So tariffs on computers were very high, and the cost of that computer might have been almost the same as buying a car.
Wow.
And that was the momentous decision. Like he decided that he's going to buy me this computer. And I remember him having an argument with my mom, who couldn't understand, why do you need to buy something so expensive? And I remember him telling my mom that you may not understand, even I may not understand, but I know he understands what to do with a computer. Now, that really changed life for me. Like I got so sucked into coding on this Apple IIe and then into the hardware, because the Apple IIe could be opened up and you can modify the hardware and do all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
So by the time I was ready to go to university 6 years later, I was a hardcore coder. And there was nothing else I would want to do more than just code. But knowing that I'm going to come back to the family business, I need to be, when I come back, what is my dad going to do with a computer programmer? We didn't even have computers in the company. But I knew we would have at some point, there will be something. So I figured being a computer programmer alone is not enough. I need to learn something about management. And that's why management information systems became the intentional choice to pursue, because it allowed me to stick to my passion and have some useful skills to bring back to the family business.
Bringing back a lot of memories. And yeah, I think I did some, I think I learned basic programming on an Atari, actually, just way back when that you could do that.
Yeah.
Not quite as advanced by today's standards. But let me ask you, so you were in university. Were you already thinking, hey, I'm going to likely join the family business? Or were you thinking, hey, there's a chance I might take a different path? Like at that point, were you more or less either expected or leaning that way? Or were you still thinking about other directions?
It was definitely join the family business, but it wasn't so much about, it wasn't like it was expected as in I have to join. It was more like I want to join.
Okay.
I had seen my dad put his life into the business. His brothers before him, he's the youngest of seven brothers, they had all put in their life into the business. And my cousins, some of my elder cousins, I had seen them. And yeah, I guess it's like what you were saying about your in your other interview. That's what we do. I'm not going to go out and get a job to be a computer programmer. But I guess being an entrepreneur in a multi-generation family business, it's not really a job, it's a calling. I would say that's what it was.
That's very well said. Wow. Wow, that's heavy. Thank you for sharing that. So you arrive and your first order of business is you said, I really want to look at and expose myself to all facets of this business. So I think in our pre-discussion, you had shared that you'd actually elected to rotate through the entire company for almost a year, like 9 months.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do that? And then let me ask that first. Why was it important for you to do that as your first step into the family business?
Yeah, so when I joined, my dad and my cousin Jayesh were both the two people that I would look up to as the ones who are going to guide me. And I was essentially told that, okay, you're going to sit at the group office. So by now, the family had a group with mm-hmm. other businesses. And I was asked to sit at the group office by my cousin Jayesh. And he said, you need to manage the plastics business by sitting at the group office and not at the factory, which it was probably the best thing that happened, because I could have easily just become part of the cogs of the machinery in the factory if I had been sitting there. So sitting at the group office gave me a bit of perspective, right? The distance gives me that perspective. The other thing was, now I'm going to the factory, right? Like, I'm not remote managing anything, but it's my desk is here, but I have to go to the factory. And as I do this, there was already a team of people there that would report to my dad. There was a general manager. He would handle sort of administration. There was really no need for me to come in and be like the group CEO or the CEO of this company. And at that time, it wasn't even declared to anyone that I'm going to be taking over from my dad's role. That only happened 9 months later. I guess part of it was, how do I make myself useful? And the other part was, how do I earn the respect of these professionals who are way more educated than me, way more qualified than me, way more experienced? So how do I earn the respect of these people? Because the last thing was that I wanted was to just be the guy who was taken for granted, right? Just because of who I'm related to.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were the reasons why I felt that I'm not just going to walk in on a red carpet and like I'm the boss. I'm just fooling myself. I decided to work in every department under the department head and learn the ropes. And only when I felt like I know enough about the whole company, would I then take a different role, but not to operate the business. Because I also realized by then that I'm much more interested in figuring out how to lay the runway for the company to grow rather than to fly the plane itself.
And it would seem that some of those learnings in MIS and computer science, while not maybe directly tactically implemented in the business, some of the underlying roots of the learning of that particular path, such as systems. You have to have systems, you have to have process. You can't just sit down and program. You have to have a strategy. You have to have a game plan.
Exactly.
All of that seemed to come into play in terms of your particular path versus, as you said, being a cog or being an operator. It almost seemed like maybe that was a predetermined path, or where your education and everything you'd learned leading up to that point was just maybe driving you to that type of a role, to be more of the architect, to be the strategist, to be ultimately the leader that you would become.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good thing, insight that you're bringing out, Ed, because the rule in computing or computer programming is that you never really want to keep debugging the same problem over and over again. That would be terrible code. And, you know, one is obviously be the architect before the builder. And the second is to build efficiently so that everything is done right the first time. And if there is a problem, then in coding, I remember spending like nights going through code, printed out on those dot matrix. The printouts would be 10 meters long, put it on the mm-hmm. ground, and I'm looking for where exactly did this code break down. And in a manufacturing context, that's called root cause analysis. Yeah, you're right. Like, I took pretty much all the lessons from coding and managed through the lens of a coder. I would say that's what defined my first probably 10 years in the business, managing through the lens of a coder.
That's cool. That's cool. Maybe the title of a future book. We'll see. So then, okay, so you're in place. And at that point, I believe the entity was then was called Sil Africa, right? It was the company named Sil Africa at that point after that first year or so, or few years in the business. Was it?
No, it was, yeah. My family started the company called Tanzania Plastics. It was a joint venture between my dad and mom's side of the family. And then a few years later, we bought another company called Simba Plastics that was started by a German family back in 1963. So we bought them out. In 79, we started, as a family, we started another factory in Kenya called Sumaria Industries, which was known as SIL, Sumaria Industries Limited, SIL. And we were essentially operating like these three companies, Simba Plastic, Tanzania Plastic, and SIL. And whenever I would go and talk to customers, I would have to keep explaining to them that we're the same company. At some point, very early on, we actually sold Tanzania Plastic in terms of the products, the machinery, but we kept the land and building because I figured we will need room for the Simba Plastic business to grow. That was the packaging business, whereas Tanzania Plastic was more of consumer plastic products. Anyway, so we had these two companies, Simba Plastic and SIL. It was such a challenge to really show customers that this is one company, and we're probably the only company at the time in East Africa that had factory in Kenya and Tanzania. So when I started meeting customers like Coca-Cola and telling them, yes, we can operate in other countries as well. We can put up a factory in Nigeria. We can put up a factory in Ethiopia. If they kept looking at us as a single country operator, it would disadvantage us. So it became very evident to me that we need to have not just one identity, as and that was the name Sil Africa, taking Sil from Kenya, the logo, which is the lion from Simba, and then Africa, is because that was the playground for the company. And you also played a role in that, right? Like you gave us that tagline, we make packaging roar, which has really worked so well for us. So that then allowed us to go out and have this sort of group identity. It also helped us internally, one board, one management team. So that was the journey of how Sil Africa came to be.
So that's, hearing you recount that, I'm just thinking about the myriad of challenges to pull that together. It's not just it's different entities doing different things to some extent, most likely different culture populations from facility to facility, different countries, probably many challenges in pulling that together. But what was the biggest challenge in your mind, looking back, like in bringing Sil Africa together as one cohesive, scalable enterprise?
Yeah, I think the big one was knowing that so it wasn't just about bringing Kenya and Tanzania to operate as one company. That was the starting point. But it was also knowing that when we put up another factory in Ethiopia, or now we just started another one last year in Maputo, in Mozambique, all of these factories have to operate on some sort of a standardized operating system. If each one's going to operate in their own way, we're not really going to be able to leverage synergies or standards or benchmarking, training. There's just, each company will just be its own piece of chaos. So to bring some order to that and preventing that chaos from happening, the thinking was we need a common operating system. So this is looking at concepts like Kaizen, and then from that and another concept called 20 Keys to develop something that we call the Sil Africa Way. So these are like 20 skill sets, we call them gears, and that became a curriculum that people would learn and get certified in and then apply that. So now if you walk into any Sil Africa factory in Africa, you would see quite a similar look and feel. In my mind at that time, I was thinking, you know, the back of the factory needs to be like a McDonald's. Right, everything's got to be standardized. Like you go to one McDonald's in Chicago, or you go to another McDonald's in London or in Australia, I'm sure the fries are exactly the same, same dimension, same taste, packed in the same way. So that was a vision for the factory, that we need to operate like that. And from that, of course, other things came in, ERP systems across the group, performance management system. But I think the big one was strategy. Like having a group strategy where we can get alignment and buy-in, and then have line of sight at the next level to know like their job matters, right? They're not just a cog in the wheel, they're actually contributing to the group strategy, and then further taking it down. That really helped to create this sort of alignment top to bottom. And then all these sort of operational standardized systems enable the business to execute in a predictable way. Simplified, it's like we had great alignment and we had great execution to feed into that alignment.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. That's quite an undertaking. And I think they had the right person for the job.
Yeah, it's probably back to that thing about the coder's approach to managing.
Yeah.
But there is something else as well, which is realizing that I don't know what I don't know. And this happened, I'm sitting in management meetings, right, as a young person, probably less than, I don't know, 3-4 years into the business. And people are able to make sense of balance sheets and cash flows. Now, I could understand a P&L account, right? Like that was reasonably simple. Cash flow also, balance sheet with a bit of difficulty. But when people are able to connect the dots between these three and tell me what's going on in the company, I have no idea how they can figure this out. So my mind would be thinking, okay, isn't it better to figure out what's going on in the company by actually going to what's happening in the company? Let's look at production reports, utilization reports, customer lead generation, pipeline, stuff like that, because that's going to tell us what are the lead indicators that contribute to those financials, rather than looking at the financials as a rearview mirror, because that's already happened in the past.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that trying to figure that out. Okay, I know I'm not going to be able to run a business by looking in the rearview mirror. That's what financial statements were for me. And so another cousin of mine, his name is Divyesh, he lives in Australia. He introduced me to a book. He gave me this book. It was about, it's called Balance Scorecard. And that got me onto this whole journey of using strategy as a structured process to grow the business.
Well, around this time, or maybe a little after, you also helped lead, I guess, a major, what I'll call a mindset shift. Because leading up to that, it was more or less customary that family members run everything in your organization. So there was a shift from that, from family members run everything, to bring the best people in, family or not. And you were essentially responsible for starting that transition. How hard was that to do? Because I know sometimes you're dealing with family, you're dealing with an emotional relationship, and then in a family business, you also have a business relationship. So you're going from saying, hey, everyone's got a role, to maybe you have a role. If you're the best person for the job, you do, but maybe you don't.
Yeah.
So that's a tough one. So how did you navigate that?
I would say that it's not, the credit doesn't go to me. It's really several different people. During the time when, as a family, we were a trading business, that was the time when, like, my dad and his brothers, all of them were having different roles. Somebody handles the money, someone handles customers, someone handles procurement, so on and so on. When we got into manufacturing, on my mom's side of the family, my mom's eldest brother passed away, but he, real visionary person, and he had the foresight of bringing in professionals into the factory. And it was, in a sense, you could say, there were certain roles that the family didn't have the talent. Of course, my dad was an engineer. He did his master's in engineering in Wisconsin at the University of Madison. He worked in a plastics factory in Illinois, and then he joined the family business. But there were other roles, right? The mechanics, the whatever, the polymer people. So by that time, they were already hiring experts. And so there was already this idea that it's not like the family is running all the key roles. Finance was another area. Like, we would typically tend to hire someone external for finance. And it went on like that. And then I think the next big transformation that happened is when my cousin Jayesh joined the family business. And he was instrumental in setting up a corporate office. So at this point now, he is looking at further professionalizing like group corporate services, like group finance, group HR, group strategy, things like that, group internal audit. And that's now creating a different dynamic between group and company.
Mm-hmm.
Back at the factory, all the departments have a professional running it. And even though by this time I'm in charge of this plastics factory, my other cousin Dipen is in charge of a pharmaceutical manufacturing factory. In Kenya, I had a couple of other cousins who were in charge of the Kenya plastics factory. We were heavily relying on the professionals. Then the next thing that happened was, and again, triggered by Jayesh, my cousin, he looked at the business through the lens of private equity. So a private equity firm approached him and said that we're interested in what you guys are doing in the pharmaceutical space. We're a pretty big, we're the largest generic drugs manufacturer in Tanzania at the time. And that started a completely different direction. That was like almost like a hockey stick.
Wow.
Because it was no longer about running the business into perpetuity. Instead, it was a start, scale, and sell. Like that became the cycle. Because obviously, as you bring a private equity in, after 5 to 8 years, sometimes 10 years, when they look at exiting, you can also exit along with them, or you become a minority, which is what happened. And in that process, the CEO of the company was no longer a family member. Because if you're a family-owned company and you're a family CEO and the private equity sells the business, they know that they can't sell the family CEO along with the business, right? Like most of the times it doesn't happen, because if you've got your money, you can basically retire and buy a yacht or a helicopter and do something else. So I guess the norm in the private equity space is that after a couple of years, the family CEO moves out and a hired gun comes in. And so that's what happened in the pharmaceutical business. And we saw the benefit of that, right? Like we saw that, you know, you can push a lot harder for growth when you've got a hired CEO, right? But it's not possible to push that hard for growth when you've got a family CEO, because either that person is a workaholic like me, happy to work 15-hour days, right? And not realizing all the damage it's doing to my family and my health. But otherwise, there would be a family member who would say, hey, I need to take my work-life balance. I need to do all these things. I think we realize the benefit of having a hired gun be the CEO for the company.
That's very, very interesting, because a lot of times the thinking around, say, family business and private equity is more either or. Either you pass the business on generationally and it becomes a family institution, or you engage in the private equity route. And in your journey, it was kind of like, why can't you do both? Why can't you serve the family and engage in private equity, ultimately for the benefit of the family and those constituents that are stakeholders? A very refreshing perspective on that, that, hey, you can do both.
Yeah.
And there is a way forward and there is a balance to be struck. That's really interesting.
I think in that context, like the idea of being a family business is, at least this is the message I would have to anyone who's in a multi-generational family. I don't think anyone wants to be an Olivetti or a Xerox, right? Like you don't want to be the family business that is in business for whatever 100, 200, 300 years, making something that eventually becomes obsolete.
Yeah, right? True.
Because that's what can happen. As a family, we have generations of people who are committed to the thing that we make, right? That becomes our identity. And when that thing is no longer needed, sometimes we don't have the agility, right, to preempt that sort of curve coming down and figure out how to reinvent ourselves. So either the approach needs to be that you become your own biggest competitor, disrupt from inside before anybody else disrupts you, or the private equity model is that the money comes into the company, you recycle the money for growth, and then as you grow and exit, then that money becomes available to start a new entrepreneurial journey, as opposed to subsequent generations of each family essentially just being glorified employees in the company. As opposed to like those The first generation entrepreneurs are the ones we always look up to, right? They knew something, they figured it out, they had the guts, they had the grit, right? Everybody else is just a shadow. Not literally, but of course, some people have gone on to great things and all that, but I have a lot of respect for first generation founders. And I think that's, to me, like being able to empower that by recycling capital instead of recycling human beings in the companies, that's where this trajectory is so powerful.
And I share your reverence for that first generation because they were that spark that kicked it off. However, also, I think coming out of your journey and especially your personal influence on the organization was you have to, as the next generation, one, have a vision of your own, and two, have the fortitude and the determination to bring about necessary change. Because let's face it, across every generational shift in a family business, the world is changing around us too. Yeah. I've had a few fifth, sixth, one seventh gen on this program, but to get there, I don't think that company had to reinvent itself probably seven times over, you know, to continue to be relevant to the challenges and changes. And even the composition of what that company is doing, maybe there's a little root of the origins, but it's very small because they've had to continue to reinvent to be relevant. And I think I'm definitely hearing strands of that in your journey. And I think what's really interesting here is that there's a very broad outlook in how you do that reinvention. It's not really, hey, we got to just be this one thing. That no, we can be many things. We just have to approach it the right way using again, back to those foundations of strategy and building processes and the right strategic architecture to approach it. And we can do anything as long as it makes sense.
Yep.
You did touch on something I wanted to come back to, 15-hour days. So in those early years, and it's not uncommon, I was a 15-hour day guy too, hard days, long days, pouring a lot of your energy, a lot of yourself into the business, and also periods away from home. What was it actually that forced you to say, hey, I've got to rethink this lifestyle. I've got to rethink how I'm living and also leading.
Yeah. So initially it was like, I didn't know right from wrong because my dad was doing 15-hour days. And I'm just like, okay, that's how it's done. And like the day I got married, normally you get married and take some time off, go on a honeymoon, right? I told my wife, sorry, too busy. You'll have to, there's no time for a honeymoon right now. Okay. By the time we had the time to take a break was 2 years later. And it was like literally forced because by that time, my wife Nuzi was pregnant with our firstborn, Akash. And I think it was, I don't remember if it was the first or the last trimester, but I felt if Akash is born and we haven't had the honeymoon, then technically it's not a honeymoon.
Interesting.
So we took a honeymoon to Mexico.
Good.
The thing is, like, the work just consumed me. It was in as much as my wife and I were going out for 10 years, madly in love, got married. But somehow the work, maybe because of this idea of sense of loyalty to the family, or I'm building on my dad's legacy, or I'm building for my children's future. Like, there were all these different things. And then I'm sure there's also a large part of my personal ambition because I'm learning a lot. I'm growing a lot. I've got the autonomy. I'm not just simply following someone else's orders. And so there's a lot of satisfaction, sense of achievement that comes out of it. But I just didn't have balance. I just didn't have balance. And then that took a toll on my health. It took a toll on my absent father, hardly ever around because the work required a lot of travel.
Sure.
And I remember whenever I would travel, my son Akash at the time would have been quite young, and he would always get a little bit unwell before I'm about to travel. And I guess those things, I didn't think about it until much later to realize me being away from him is having a physiological reaction. And I wish I had been more mindful, been around and be a dad and not just simply be like the provider.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. And I think we take a lot of good from that previous generation. We also take some maybe not so good in that whole you know, idea of being a workaholic. To me, probably to some people, the idea of working on a Saturday or Sunday or both is a little foreign. To me, it's like, yeah, it's, you do what you need to do. So what?
Yeah, exactly.
But to your point, making sure that we take time for those that ultimately we're working for and we're fighting for. And that's our family and our loved ones that need our time and attention too. And I'm glad to hear that you scaled back those 15-hour days, and I have too.
So now it's, I try to avoid doing any, start doing any sort of like work meetings or anything before 10 a.m. I get up early. I'll do all my health stuff. I've got a great routine. I do a cold plunge in the morning. There's a bunch of other biohacking stuff that I'm into, like just making sure I'm around, not just as a body, right, but as an active human being.
Yes.
and it's also feeding into, as I, because by this age, I'm 55 now, and people start asking about questions like legacy and all that. And I'm thinking, like, beyond the family business, like beyond whatever venture that I've invested in, what's the real thing that actually matters is that if I can figure out how entrepreneurs, especially like young or startup entrepreneurs or early stage, small size, to not go through what I went through, right? Not have to think like it takes 15 hours a day to get your business off the ground, right? And you have to sacrifice your health and your family relationships and lose your friends in the pursuit of growing a business. And then at the end of that journey, when you look back, it's really not the first thing that you ever wanted to do anyway. So I want to try and figure out how I can apply myself in that direction for as many entrepreneurs that I can help.
Awesome. And I think you answered my next question as you kind of look to the future and look back. Let's talk about it for a moment. What's exciting you right now, that you're into right now? What's something that's really exciting you in your journey right now?
So the company Seal Africa is actually at another major pivot point, because the private equity that had invested in us, their fund, as it does with all private equities, right, comes to an end, and then they need to make an exit. And so we're repeating the same playbook as a family as that we've done in pharmaceuticals and FMCG by bringing in a strategic investor who will probably take the majority stake and then be available for a transition period for a few years. And that's going to help the business itself. Obviously, now the business has a life of its own beyond the family. And I think it'll help the business to really go to that level that we as family, human and financial capital cannot take it. And I think we also realize that at some point, the ownership of the business becomes the bottleneck and it needs a new owner. Who has the talent, the capital, and the vision to be able to take it to wherever that business deserves to be. So that's, I think, we're in the transition of doing that. And I think that's going to keep me engaged in the business for another few more years. But because I'm not operating the business on a day-to-day basis, like my focus is entirely on innovation, on strategy, circular economy, not just through innovation, but also through legislation. Making sure that the industry is the right environment legislatively to be able to grow in the right way and be a responsible plastics packaging manufacturer. We're not just doing this for financial. If plastics is a problem, then plastics can also be a solution. So there's a lot of my time that goes into those areas. And I think it's important that we set the example for the industry that profitability and sustainability can coexist. If you can innovate, if your business models are the right way, then it can certainly be possible. So that's one piece that's keeping me quite engaged and busy. The other is in YPO. I joined the organization about 14 years ago, a year after I joined EO, the UN EO. And then I was invited to the CEO organization about 3 years ago. Now, all of these YPO, EO, CEO are all, to me, I would say they represent the kaleidoscope of life, right? Like my business, if it was just me and my business and my family, that's fine. I've got a pair of binoculars and that's all I'm looking through. But YPO, EO, and CEO bring a kaleidoscope, because in my forum, I've got 6, 7 other people, other entrepreneurs, other CEOs, and each one is bringing their own different perspectives of life.
Sure.
In my chapter, in my region, in my network, everyone is bringing their own unique perspective. There's so much to learn from that. Like one is like just knowing how much I don't know is obviously that brings a lot of grounding and humility. But then having access to people to be able to open up that whole world of learning more about myself, learning more about how I can change myself in terms of my health or in terms of my outlook. And at some point, just knowing what not to chase. All of these are so important. So because of that, I commit a lot of time, relatively speaking, into YPO, because that's where I've been taking more leadership roles. And yeah, so that's been quite something amazing.
That's awesome. And I think a lot of people maybe misunderstand thinking that leadership, if you're a leader, you're interacting with people all the time. And that's true. But leadership in and of itself can also be rather isolating. And sometimes you feel a little bit alone, and organizations and peer groups like the ones you belong to, like the one we jointly belong to, create that peerness and mutual understanding. I'm always surprised with a leader, a CEO further along than me. I come to them maybe with a challenge or problem thinking they've cracked the code. And they're like, oh, don't we all have that problem? I'm like, oh gosh, okay. So you have that problem too. It's just you have it on a bigger level than I do. And it's refreshing and daunting at the same time to have those exchanges, but very healthy.
Yeah.
And certainly broadens our horizons.
And on that point, on that point about when people look at, okay, are you faffing around attending forum meetings for 4 hours and then like every month, how can you take 6 hours out of your work or your family time? And I used to get a lot of those questions from people who are not in your YPO. And my reaction to them would be that I'd say it's the single biggest time hack that I have found. The single biggest time hack. Yep. Because every month, I learn about at least 7 different problems or 8 problems, depending on how many we have in the forum.
Yeah.
And I learn from other people's experience how they figured out to solve it. And rather than me going back into my business and stumbling and fumbling and bumbling around, doing trial and error and figuring out, and only after spending a lot of time, money and effort, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars and years later realizing this was the wrong thing, I figured it out after one forum meeting.
There was a forum, and I won't name names or go into specifics, but I've been doing something repeatedly over a series of years. And it was through the conversation, it was starting to dawn on me, like maybe that was not the path. And I said, but I've been doing this repeatedly for so many years. And the response was something like, that's okay. Now you just realize that you've been making a mistake repeatedly for 3 years and now you can fix it. So don't worry about it.
Yeah,
it's gone. Yeah. Right now, fix it and stop doing it for the next.
I think it's like Thomas Edison with the light bulb, right?
Yeah. Last question, actually. If any of our, and we could go on and on for another 2 hours probably with this conversation, but last question would be, if any of our listeners wanted to learn more about your story, your journey, or learn more about Sil Africa or some of the other companies that you're involved with, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
Easy. That's LinkedIn. So yeah, just look me up. It's Akshay Shah. I think my LinkedIn handle is Akshay Sumaria. But anyway, if you look me up on LinkedIn, just type Akshay Shah, Sil Africa. I'm sure it'll come up. We can put the link in your show notes as well.
Absolutely.
I always reply on that. And then also, I try to be active on LinkedIn. Like, I'm not necessarily trying to be a blogger, podcaster, whatever, one of those. It would be nice to be one of those people, but I don't have the time to do that. But I do use LinkedIn as a way to just make people, I guess, hear what I have to say. Whatever is my public opinion about anything.
Absolutely. Okay. We'll definitely include that in the show notes. So actually, your story truly reflects the full spectrum of family business journey, the roots, the expectations, the expansion, a few missteps along the way, but then reinvention and some really deep personal growth that is often happening behind the scenes. What resonates for me most is your honesty about your journey, the sacrifice, the identity, the courage that you've had to do some of the things that you had to do, and ultimately to take the steps you needed to take to modernize and bring a multi-generational enterprise forward without losing its identity, without losing its soul. So thank you so much for sharing your journey and your perspectives with us today. Again, we've been speaking with Akshay Shah of Sil Africa, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll see you next time. Akshay, thank you so much for sharing your story and your journey with us today. Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeliaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.